I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Atlantic City, New Jersey may be on a winning streak. A few years back, five casinos closed down, thousands of workers lost their jobs, and the state took over the city's finances. But today, city officials were hailing what they called a bright spot in Atlantic City's recovery, the opening of two new casinos, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today for the opening of Hard Rock Hotel and Casino Atlantic City. We are so excited.
2 years ago, after a bitter fight with workers, the Trump Taj Mahal closed down. It was one of five casinos that closed in recent years as the gambling town saw customers migrate to casinos in neighboring states. But the people gathered in a conference room in the new Hard Rock Casino Hotel this morning weren't thinking about the past. Jim Allen is chairman of Hard Rock International.
And we believe this project will create a new renaissance in the future and the expansion, the excitement of Atlantic City going back to be one of the entertainment cities, great entertainment cities in the United States.
And the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino opened this week, bringing with it nearly 4,000 jobs. And it wasn't the only one. Ocean Resort Casino held its grand opening in the property that was once home to the failed Revel Casino. Frank Gilliam is the mayor of Atlantic City.
The beauty of what we're experiencing right now is something that 3 or 4 years ago we weren't basically even in the running.
The news is good for the casino industry, but small businesses across the city are hoping the good fortune will trickle down to them.
Our business is not dependent on casinos. Our business is dependent on families.
Nabil Azim runs his family's gift shop on the Atlantic City boardwalk. He says what Atlantic City really needs is to attract more families to the seaside town.
We need like a amusement park, like a Six Flags or Dorney.
Nonetheless, Azim is glad to see the casinos opening, hoping they will add a little bit to his bottom line.
So since Hard Rock Cafe and the Ocean Resorts came, we hope the business will be a little better. And it is always hope in life.
From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A Philadelphia nonprofit is sending more than 100 children's books to kids at the Berks County Residential Center. It's a federal detention facility for families awaiting decisions about their immigration cases. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, the delivery comes as the national debate around immigration hits another boiling point.
More than 20 kids are living with their fathers at the Berks Detention Center, a roughly two-hour drive from Philadelphia. The vast majority of them are from Central America, either Guatemala or Honduras, which is why all of these brand new books are in Spanish.
Some are graphic novels, some are classic sports books. It's the whole gamut of children's literature.
Tim Whitaker is the executive director of Mighty Writers, the youth program sending the books thanks to a $3,000 grant. He says he hopes the books can help put detained kids at ease.
Maybe having a book in their hands with pictures of children that look like themselves or a book they might have had back in their country where they came from, maybe that'll provide some comfort or relief. And that seems like a good idea.
To add a human touch to the delivery, Spanish-speaking students at Mighty Writers designed a batch of personalized bookmarks. Some of them have hearts, spaceships, or a row of trees. Others, like the one Alma created, have messages of hope.
I wrote "Keep calm and read on," and like "Believe in yourself."
Alma says she liked the idea of giving the children at Berks a chance to relax and learn, but she also wanted them to know there's someone thinking about them.
Like, I know that I don't know them very well, but I feel like I have a connection with them because they're like kind of like my family. All immigrants are like everyone, like we're all family, like no matter what.
We're not using Alma's last name because some of her family is undocumented. If everything goes according to plan, the books will be at the detention center early next week as activists, lawyers, and lawmakers fight to shut down the facility because of conditions inside and an ongoing license dispute. And as tensions flare over a Trump administration policy that led to children being separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania newsrooms have been documenting the opioid crisis for many years, and starting July 1st, they're kicking off a county-by-county review of the extent of the problem and pointing to possible solutions. Kate Barron is vice president for content at Penn Live, and she's coordinating State of Emergency, searching for solutions to Pennsylvania's opioids crisis. Kate, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. And I have to say right away, I'm also having a lot of help. Larry Rosenthal, Pennsylvania editor for AP, and a sturdy band of editors from around the state are helping out with this project.
Does the term state of emergency in part refer to how Governor Wolf described and labeled the extent of the crisis?
Yeah, we thought it was a perfect name for this package, but it also really the emphasis should be on state, because what we wanted to do, as you mentioned, all of us have been covering this incredibly terrible epidemic for years. I mean, nigh on to almost 20 years. And we've been doing it from our individual newsrooms. What we wanted to do was really do a blanket coverage project across Pennsylvania to see what was going on from every corner of the state.
And so you've described a 20-year arc, though the problem has certainly accelerated in recent years.
Yes, it sure has. And again, we've been doing a lot of stories on statistics, on just, you know, what you'd expect out of this. What we decided we wanted to focus on, because we were very concerned that a numbness was almost setting in, people were getting fatigue over these stories, we decided to focus for this project on solutions, on what things are working. They can be small projects up to really big medical innovations, big therapy projects. But we were trying to look across the state at what each county was doing that was showing some hope, a little bit of promise out there.
So, for example, here in Philadelphia, focusing on safe injection sites.
Well, exactly. In fact, the Philadelphia Inquirer is doing a story on injection sites as well. Also in Philly, we have columnist Mike Newell. He's doing something on us on a course that Temple is using to teach journalism students how to cover the crisis. That's how major it's become.
How major has it become, and where does Pennsylvania rank in the nation?
2016, Pennsylvania was ranked fourth highest rate of opioid overdose deaths in the country. That adds up to about 2,200. And again, opioid deaths are responsible for about half of all drug overdose deaths in general. So you can double that figure.
So again, focusing on solutions, in addition to safe injection sites in neighboring Delaware County, they apparently pioneered the use of Narcan.
Yes, that's right. They talk about how they were first in that. And we have a story on that going, too. Others in your area, in Montgomery County, there's a really innovative adoption agency that's working with addicted mothers who are just unable to raise their babies in their homes. One of, I thought, the most interesting stories we did, in Lackawanna County, the Times Tribune found a guy, he'd been a recovering addict, who really felt compelled to try and get resource information out to people struggling with addiction. He, on his own dime, produced his own cards with resource numbers, then went around to all the pharmacies in Lackawanna County, asking them to include them in the prescription bags when people are coming in to pick up opioids and syringes. And they did it. He's hoping to take that statewide and even nationwide. Again, some of these are really small steps. There is obviously no one comprehensive solution to this epidemic, but we did want to really shine a light on what is good out there, what's going on, what's happening, what could show some hope.
Coming back to our region, proof positive that no section of the state is immune. While Chester County describes itself as the healthiest and wealthiest county in the state, they too have a huge problem with opioid addiction and fatalities, and describe the so-called warm handoff concept in use there.
It's all about how after people have been identified as addicted, how they just don't let people come back from a Narcan treatment and then go back out into the community because, again, they're going to relapse. The recidivism rate is just atrocious for this, and it's making sure that they have that support that they can get after they've been in.
As you cited at the top, a fatigue factor with consumers of this kind of information. How do you break through it with this project?
It's all about blanketing coverage. We want to get as many media companies as possible to run these stories throughout the week starting July 1st. I've done some of these joint statewide projects before in my work with some statewide journalism organizations, but this is the first time that we were able to get more than 40 newsrooms contributing stories to this package. So I am hoping that you will see stories about solutions popping up in your newspapers, on TV, and so you just won't hopefully be able to avoid this when you're looking at your websites, watching TV, getting your paper the week of July 1st.
Kate Barron, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Kate Barron is Vice President for Content at Penn Live, and she coordinates State of Emergency, searching for solutions to Pennsylvania's opioids crisis. Common Space continues its second broadcast season on WHYY this Sunday night with an episode focusing on mothers and daughters. In keeping with the theme of this weekend's show, here's a story from Kelsey Stewart about the straight scoop her mother gave her about knowing when she'll have found the one.
So my mom always said that eating peas would make my eyes sparkle. And it wasn't until I was 18, registered to vote and about to leave for my freshman year of college, that I realized that that actually wasn't based in real science. And it was in fact just made up bullshit. So I stopped eating peas. It was the first decision I made as an independent college woman. And you know, college is a time when you make a lot of those types of choices. Choices that feel really big at the time, but turn out not to mean anything, like, what should I study? And then all those little choices that seem inconsequential, but have long-lasting impact, like, should I have one or two scoops of ice cream for breakfast? And of course, surrounded by so many people closest to your age, what about love? I was thinking about love one night in my dorm room near the end of my first semester. I had just gotten back from the Student Union Center where I worked in the kitchens. And I was thinking about love because I had spent my shift making out with someone in an industrial freezer. So naturally, I was wondering, how do you know when you found the one? And I was glad it happened near the end of my semester because I knew in a few days my dad would be coming to pick me up. And I could ask him for some advice on love in the 3-hour car ride home. And I didn't want to ask anyone else about love because I was lucky. And for me, my parents have always been an example of people who chose right in love. They got married in 1977. And to this day, they still accidentally show up to events wearing the same t-shirt. Which means after 41 years of marriage, they still love each other so much that they want to buy matching clothing. So he picks me up and we start the ride home from Penn State. And I say, Dad, when did you know Mom was the one? And he looks out at the mountains and he says, well, Kelsey, your mother has always been the most cosmic woman I have ever met. Ah, shit, man. Cosmic? Was I ever going to find anyone to describe me as cosmic? And then he went on to tell me the moment. He had been on a road trip with a bunch of friends that included my mother and had the misfortune of being designated overnight driver. And while everyone else slept, my mom stayed awake with him, and he said they had the best conversation. I was thinking about that game changer of a conversation the first couple days of break. It must have been something. And then I started to wonder, had my mom had the same moment? Was that her moment for my dad? Is that how love worked? And so one night I walked into the kitchen where my mom was eating cheese and loading the dishwasher. And I said, hey, Mom, when did you know Dad was the one? And she quick put a piece of cheese in her mouth. And I started to wonder, did my mom forget her moment? Should I remind her about that life-changing conversation? And just as I opened my mouth to give her a little bit of a hint, she turned and she said, Kels, the first time your father and I had sex in your Nana's house, I started to think it might be a long-term setup. And I thought, I gotta start eating peas again because my mother is this brilliant woman who obviously gives great advice. In life, I should be eating vegetables. And in love, yes, conversation and connection. But I gotta make sure that sex is dynamite. Thanks, Mom.
Kelsey Stewart is an educator and artist who lives in Philadelphia. You can listen to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY-FM this Sunday night at 8 on WHYY and via podcast. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.